long history of punishing Haiti. And so, when you look at Haiti today, you look at the situation of just insecurity. This is bad for North American capitalism. It is bad when you have a situation with this level of insecurity and, political dysfunction. That's not good for Canadian sweatshop interests in Haiti. That's not good for potential Canadian mining interests in Haiti. That it's got to a point, it's just not good for business interests basically across the board.
And I'd like to jump in here, Yves Engler. I was watching Al Jazeera, as is my wont, and I was watching an interview with Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, who's the head of this G9 alliance, and he's apparently the lead gang leader. And he was kind of talking a certain talk. He was sounding like he was an anti-imperialist, sounding like he was struggling for justice and liberation from, the enslavement by corporate interests. Who is this guy, Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier? And then there's this other gang leader, Gabriel Jean-Pierre, who leads the gang GPEP. And they're apparently, we're competing now, they're in an alliance. Do you think, to a certain degree, these people are actually responding to politically to Haiti's domination of Western powers over Haiti? Is there an element of a political, a reasoned, coherent, principled, political aspect or elements to what they're engaged in? Or is it just, to take the opposite extreme, is it just pure criminality? Because I understand these guys just routinely engage in, they were reportedly mass killings, sexual violence, extortion. Who are these gangs and where do they come from?
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly an element that people have to understand. To have an anti-imperialist rhetoric in Haiti is not a, everyone has an anti-imperialist rhetoric in Haiti, right? Even the Haitian elite who work hand in glove with Washington will often come forward with anti-imperialist rhetoric. The country is so penetrated by North American imperialism that it's just widely held. Ariel Henry was appointed to lead the country nearly 3 years ago through a tweet, literally through a tweet of the core group. And the core group is just foreign ambassadors who have this little group that they've set up that they get together, led by the US and Canada. They have a few others, the French, Brazilian, Spanish, EU representative, OAS representative. And they basically come up with their plan for Haitian affairs. And they announce it, and a lot of the time it ends up being policy. Like this is a country so penetrated.
And this is after Jovenel Moise was assassinated.
Exactly. This is what happened when Jovenel Moise was assassinated. Moise was somebody who had been basically put in there by the PHTK, by Martelly, who was Martelly, Canada, the US, and after the earthquake of 2010, intervened in the election and just decided with no tabulation basis that this guy should be in the second round of the runoff, in the runoff.
Canada intervened.
Intervened in like the level, like it was just crass, totally open. They just totally openly, Hillary Clinton literally goes to Haiti amidst this all this devastation and says, if you don't do this, we're coming, everything's cutting off. Préval, the president at the time, whose candidate, who was actually was should have been the second round, he was like threatened, all your visas are gone, his daughters who are going to school in the US, like they're gonna wreck that. Like this was totally open. They didn't have any electoral basis for it, any tabulation basis, but they were able to just impose it.
So Jovenel Moise was imposed as the new.
Martelly is a former like Duvalier. He was in the Tontamacourt. He's just like really, I mean, almost people, basically a sort of deranged musician who on his in his concerts he pisses on the audience and just like total mockery of Haiti, really. Like you can the figure who's going to mock the country the most, he was one right at the top of the list. They imposed him to be president in 2010, and then he basically chose Jovenel Moïse. Not basically, Jovenel Moïse was like a nobody. No one knew who this guy was, and Martelly saw Moïse as his the continuation. He'll have all the power because Moïse doesn't have really his own base. And he got basically imposed him. It was technically there was elections and totally dubious, and then had to do another round and even more dubious. But they just, with the backing of the outside, with the U.S. and Canada, was made president. And then he was assassinated, probably almost certainly by based upon a an internal power squabble within the Peashtika, Martelli's factions, looks like with at least an okay from Washington. So Moise is assassinated, and then there's three different officials. Like, where this is a very Moise at this point, when he's assassinated, has very, very, he never really had legitimacy, but has even less legitimacy based upon his mandate running out, whatever. And then there's three different figures that are claiming to the position of prime minister. And the core group jumps in and puts out a tweet and says, it's Ariel Henry, who was, we should point out, was on the Council of the Wise that they created after the 2004 coup that appointed the coup government in 2004. And then Ariel Henry is made prime minister. Nothing, no constitutional of any, no type of, no popular legitimacy, constitutional legitimacy, because the core group comes out and says he's the prime minister. And then he refuses to hold elections, you know, almost 3 years refusing to hold elections. There was a whole transition plan, right? Haitian civil society had this transition plan, which early on had very widespread buy-in, the so-called Montana Accord. Later on, it sort of collapses, but early on, it has like complete buy-in across the political spectrum. This whole process of transition that takes place, I forget the exact timeline, it was like 18 months, and then the election is held. You have these sort of like relatively non-political figures that are going to run things. It seemed like a sensible plan.
And what was the position of the core group, the United States, Canada, France, and others, vis-a-vis that transition plan?
They undermined it by saying, no, Ariel Henry leads, and we're going to keep backing him as he doesn't hold elections, as he doesn't negotiate seriously, as he refuses the Montana Accord. And so no one in Haiti likes Ariel Henry. Like, no one, and everyone believes he's appointed from afar. So when these gang leaders say they oppose Ariel Henry, everyone agrees with them, right? Whether they agree with the gang leaders or not, that's a different question, but on that position right there. And then going one step further with regards to their, you know, anti-imperialist rhetoric, again, basically everyone agrees with them, because basically everyone agrees that even those who might want, and I think there are some, though obviously exaggerated in our media, but there are some, and I probably a significant chunk of the Port-au-Prince population who want some sort of foreign force to deal with this insecurity problem, they still oppose imperialism. Because everyone knows this, you don't hear this in the Canadian media, right? The Canadian media talks about, oh, we've refused to intervene in Haiti. We're just like letting the country, you know, we're not doing what's right and taking the, you know, Haitians by the hand and helping them out. But it's just a joke, right? We're like intervening in Haiti all the time. There is not a moment where Canada's not intervening in Haiti, whether that form is a military operation, whether that form is, you know, the core group and political decisions like that, whether that form is funding the police, whether that form is funding NGOs to use as tools to advance our interests, whether that form is having police on the ground. There's all different forms of it, of course. But we are, as in the U.S. even more so, always intervening in Haiti. That like has not stopped. I mean, you can went from the American perspective, it clearly has not stopped since 1915 with the occupation.
So like back in October, early October, the UN Security Council passed a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, thereby triggering an actual international intervention in Haiti, Chapter 7 intervention, which is exactly what should happen with Gaza. This is another story. The United States, the Security Council could bring peace to Gaza immediately and actually, you know, trigger a very rapid movement towards a two-state solution or final resolution if there were to actually be an international intervention telling Israel to get out of Gaza. Chapter 7 resolution, that's another story. That's never going to happen. But last October, right around October 7th, right around Hamas's attack on southern Israel, UN Security Council passes Chapter 7 resolution on Haiti, calling for an intervention. And that intervention is now, it's now gearing up. Kenya has been asked to come in. Kenya's balking, and so on and so forth. Talk about this. And I mean, if these gang leaders are opposed to an international intervention, they're saying, no way, Jose. Will they actually be able to block or stop an international intervention? And if they do, what would they do? What would they then segue towards in terms of bringing peace and security to Haiti, if at all? Or would they just establish themselves as, you know, gang chieftains?
I'm not making an argument for the gangs. I think the gangs are brutal and they have been basically terrorizing the population. What I'm saying is that they have some legitimacy in the demand specifically around Ariel Henry against imperialism, and also they come out of the poor neighborhoods, right? And anyone who knows, like, the class divide in the country is just so astounding that it's clear to everyone, right? And you know, there's just a basically 20 families, mostly light-skinned, who control almost the entire economy. And then there's the impoverished, you know, maybe 5 or 10% that's sort of a professional kind of, you know, so-called middle-class kind of domain. And then the, you know, 80%, 90% who are just the impoverished masses. So they also, when they talk about, like, the class divide, and they do talk about the class divide, though they don't act on the class divide.
You're saying the gang leaders talk about the class divide.
Gangleaders talk about the class. Like, if you listen to Charizier au barbecue, he talks about the class divide. I don't believe this. I mean, Charizier was a police officer, and he was implicated in a terrible massacre. And I think he's repressive. He's adopted socialistic anti-imperialist rhetoric because it serves his interests. And, you know, maybe I think it's possible to believe that him more than the other gang leaders, maybe there's a little bit more of a genuine element to it, but mostly, no, they're mostly just terrorizing the population.
And this guy, Gabriel Jean-Pierre with the GPEP, is he pretty much the same?
Even more so. I haven't heard his rhetoric even being what Charizier's rhetoric has been. From the kind of gang perspective, that's not the model. Now, the problem, so there's this foreign, the UN mission, it's important to note that this isn't actually a UN mission. The Security Council agreed to the mission, but it's not under a UN, the normal UN structure. So that's why the US, which initially wanted Canada to lead it, and the Canadian military didn't want to lead it for their own reasons, right? The Canadian military, well, they want to be the part of the big boys that have troops on NATO mission on Russia's border. They want to send troops to, you know, contain China. That's what they want. They don't want this sort of peacekeeping-ish kind of Haiti mission. So the Canadian military didn't want to do it. And so Canada began with the U.S. searching out for Caribbean countries, and basically wasn't that much pickup. And then finally, the Americans got Kenya to do it, to accept that. And if you look at Kenya, I mean, there's no real, like, reason for this. Kenya is, like, I mean, it's very far away, right? The reason they would want Kenya, I think, is partly to put a kind of black face on the mission. But Kenyans don't even speak French, which is a secondary language, you know, pretty, they obviously don't speak Haitian or Haitian Creole. But then the Kenyans, basically, it was challenged in Kenyan court, and the judge says, no, we don't have any security agreement with this country, and so we can't be sending our police. Apparently, the Kenyan court also, Kenya can't also can't, it's it, if they're going to send any forces international, it's supposed to be the military, according to the Kenyan constitution. So then why Ariel Henry was in Kenya was to basically sign this security agreement, which would stop the block that the Kenyan court had put on dispatching troops. And that's when the gangs intervened with the airport and took over one of the prisons and basically made it so Ariel Henry couldn't return to the country.
So Ariel Henry is in Kenya?
No, he's in Puerto Rico now. So he came back to the hemisphere, and then he was blocked. They had made it, basically they stopped a lot of the flights going into the Toussaint Louverture airport in Port-au-Prince.
So he's now stepped down. He's quit, Ariel Henry. He's in Puerto Rico. He's announced that he's resigning.
Yeah, but he said he's resigning once the transition is in place. So it's not, hadn't actually resigned. And there's this transition council that's what the suggestion that came out of this CARICOM meeting.
The Caribbean Community and Common Market.
Yeah, and so Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, Canada's U.N. Ambassador Bob Rae were there in the CARICOM meeting to discuss Haiti. And this proposal that they come up with about this transition council is a seven-person transition council supposed to represent different political factions and other factions in the country. But it includes things like, so you can't be part of this transition if you say you don't agree with the foreign military security force entering the country. Okay. So the foreigners get together and create this body that they say is going to be representative of Haitian, whatever. But a stipulation is that they have to basically agree with our perspective on foreign intervention. Then there's also other stipulation there. Like, you can't complain about any election results, right? So you have to just agree that whatever the electoral council, and anyone who knows Haiti, like that in principle kind of might sound almost okay, but everyone knows, you know, there's this huge history of ballot, you know, different forms of ballot stuffing and whatever. The most outrageous one was the 2006 after the coup in 2004, where René Préval, who was had been Aristide's prime minister in the past and viewed as sort of like close to Aristide, he wins the election in 2000, the presidential election in 2006. And the U.S. and Canada, I mean, Canada was right in the middle. The former head of Election Canada, Jean-Pierre Kingsley, he was like oversees this body. And they were just like thousands of ballots were found burnt and stuff. And they were basically trying to block Préval from getting over the 50% mark. So he would just win in the first round. The next candidate had like 12%. And Canada just supported this aggressive, like open ballot stuffing process, all designed to maintain the 2004 coup and to continue that. And then they used it as a way to weaken Préval and say there was, you know, his election was questionable, which was like, you know, totally comical. So even a stipulation like that, to put that in, like who is Bob Rae and who is Anthony Blinken to decide that, you know, Haitian representatives have to go along with a foreign intervention, go along with their perspective on the Electoral Council. But this is just considered like acceptable in Haiti. And the Canadian officials, while they're doing this, right, they'll talk endlessly about that we need a Haitian solution, right? We have to support Haitian actors. It's a farce.
So Eve Engler, wrapping this up, what do you see the outcome of all this? How do you see things progressing? I mean, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It is a basket case. And it's hard to kind of cast your eye on Haiti and have any sort of hope for any kind of emergence from this. How do you see, like, in another universe, if we were in another universe, how would you see this being resolved? And what role would you see Haitian civil society and the gangs, the competing interests playing in bringing about, you know, peace and security and harmonious development? It's hard to imagine in Haiti.
Well, it is, but you know, this, you go back to like the 2000 elections and the Aristide elections. There's no government in this hemisphere I'm aware of in recent decades where there was more unanimity of political perspective
than in Haiti.
Yeah, in Haiti in the early 2000s, they won, the Famille Lavalas won, like, there were 7,000 elected positions, and they won over 70% of, from the mayors to the Senate to, right? They won everything. So the unanimity or the political support for that movement was, there's no other, you know.
What was the name of the movement?
Famille Lavalas. It comes out of the Lavalas movement that overthrew Jean-Claude Duvalier's dictatorship in 86, and which means the flood, right? The flash flood that came down from the hills, you know, came down from the slums to oust the dictatorship.
And this was Aristide.
That was Aristide's political party, right? And they won everything, and we destroyed it. So there's much more political coherence in Haiti than there is in Canada. We destroyed that. That's why we destroyed it, because there was such a widespread popular support. So that there's no reason that can't happen again. Now, I agree with you. The situation is absolutely grim, right? You have a situation where the gangs, you know, a foreign military intervention very likely could be good at the level of lessening insecurity in the short to medium term. So that could be a positive. The problem is, what it does is it reinforces Haiti's main problem, which is foreign domination, right? So you're caught in this impossible position. If you have a foreign military force, you might do something good in the short term, but you're going to reinforce this bigger problem. So that gets us to, where are Haiti's problems really based? I don't think Haiti's problem, I mean, Haiti has an endless stream of problems within Haiti, but it's a matter of too many of Haiti's decisions are made in Paris, Washington, Ottawa. And so much of Haiti, you know, getting out of its, basket case, in the word you used, or impoverishment, or just fundamental injustice, comes through movements taking place in the imperial core. And then I guess the other part to this is that, you know, when things are so grim, pretty small improvements, which are, you know, absolutely doable in the short term, right? You know, improving education, improving health system, they mean a lot to people. When someone is so impoverished and in such difficult circumstances to have the ability to go to school for free, at least until, you know, grade 7, that's a big step forward, right? The ability to eat three times a day, that's so small developments that can actually happen pretty quickly if there was any political will for that, can make quite a big difference in people's lives.
Last question, Eve Engler, and thank you so much for joining me. What could the Canadian government do? I mean, if suddenly, you know, Justin Trudeau, something sort of entered his brain in the middle of the night, or the NDP were to become the governing power in Canada, if you can imagine such a thing, what could Canada do? And what's the potential for Canada, the Canadian government, to make a principled shift in its policy towards Haiti?
There have been two different parliamentary petitions in recent years calling on Canada to put out all the documents about the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti and to apologize. The Ottawa Initiative in Haiti is the meeting where they brought U.S., French, Canadian officials together and Organization of American States officials together 13 months before the coup of 2004. And they basically consolidated the international forces that would perpetrate the coup, or they, if you want to call it that, they planned the coup. So put out all the documents. Let's air this. Let's discuss this and let's apologize for it. That would be the first step. So there has to be some recognition of what Canada has done. Now, should there be restitution? There should be some financial compensation for that. I think there should be, but let's leave that aside for the moment and start with just admitting what has happened as the first step towards, you know, actually changing your policy. Now, I'm very hesitant to promote. I completely believe in a system of international solidarity, financially speaking. So the wealthier parts of the world provide resources to the more impoverished places to enable them to get into a better position. And I've argued this before, that there's a transfer payment system within Canada where the wealthier provinces transfer money to the poorer provinces and this kind of stuff. I think something like that should be adopted globally, right? I think that's kind of the model we should be going at. And at some point, one region of the world is going to be wealthier, another point is going to, and you shift the balance like that. So I totally believe in that. Now, in the current climate, I'm very hesitant to say Canada has any role in assisting Haiti, because the whole ethos of our political culture is this idea of this benevolence, Canada coming and helping Haiti and bring these backwards people and this kind of stuff like that. Invariably, it's just a cover for imperialism. But even when it's like less actually imperialistic, because I think there are many people in the NGO sector, for instance, who are not meaning to be imperialistic, but they end up propping up a system that has just inequities just riven through it. And until we sort of equilibrium on these injustices and inequities, it's just so difficult to actually, you know, do quote unquote charity in a way that isn't just reinforcing. So, and that includes with the Canadian government. So I completely believe that the Canadian government should be, you know, if there is a genuine elected popular government in Haiti, we should be assisting that government to, you know, build its, you know, one of the main things is the whole agricultural sector, right? They've deinvested from production internally. And that's been policies that Canada played a role in, but the U.S. principally destroying the rice, destroying the pigs, whatever, in the back of the 80s and 90s. So that process, we should be supporting those kind of things. But I'm very hesitant to actually propose that, because in the current climate, it just reinforces this kind of benevolent model. But the first phase is apologize for what we've done, admit what we've done, and let Haitians figure out things for themselves.
Not a lot of hope.
I mean, there's not a lot of hope, but it can be done, right? It's been done. You know, if you can overthrow the most brutal of the slave plantation economy, and that's what Haiti was, Saint-Domingue during the French rule, it was the most brutal, right? It had this the most number of slaves for per white person, and had the most brutal methods of controlling the Africans. If you can overthrow that and overthrow the different empires that, you know, British Empire with Canadians part of it, trying to reimpose that slave system, you can certainly, I mean, it's totally doable to get out of the current climate. It's not easy, but I genuinely believe that if foreign forces don't undermine the initiatives that 75-80% of Haitians have repeatedly backed, then the country can improve quite a bit, quite rapidly.
Eve Engler is a Montreal-based writer and political commentator and the author of 13 books. His latest, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, co-written with Owen Schalk, documents Canada's contribution to the ouster of over 20 elected governments around the world, including the popular Haitian government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We'll link to Eve Engler at greenplanetmonitor.net. For today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.